Okay, thank you, everybody. We're about to begin our third and final panel, investigating the rule of law and its application to national security. Professor John Satir will be our moderator for today's panel. Thank you.
So the topic for this final panel of the session is the role of security forces in promoting the rule of law. We have an eminent set of panelists from a variety of backgrounds. Our first speaker will be Colette Rausch, whose resume consists entirely of places that have an abstract bureaucratic, is this working? There, an abstract bureaucratic noun followed by of, followed by a good thing. So she worked at the Department of Justice. Now she's at the Institute of Pieces, Rule of Law, Center of Innovation. Colette, without further ado.
Thank you. I've never thought of it that way. I kind of like that. What I would like to do is to link back to the first panel and Professor Tamanaha's comments and discuss some of the common points he brought up and then link that to security forces. And my comments stem from about 12 years of work that I have done, either living or traveling to different countries that have something in common. And they all have in common they've been through wars. And so the comments that I'm making stem from that experience and are naturally colored by that experience. And also they're colored by the fact that we're always learning. And so some of the things that I did early on in my career that were fashionable at the time that I will discuss have deemed to be not so fashionable now. And we're on a new horizon. And then some of the things I'm going to talk about at the end are some of the themes that I think a lot of us who are struggling as we stay up and try to determine what is the rule of law and some of the things the panel discussed, the new horizon and where we think things might go. As mentioned, I'm from the U.S. Institute of Peace. USIP is in Washington, D.C. It is an agency that is funded by Congress, and it's an independent agency established by Congress with a mandate to help prevent and resolve violent conflicts around the world. And we do that through a number of different avenues, working with our various federal agencies, working with NGOs abroad through grants and fellowships. And my focus, obviously, is on the rule of law. And previously, a lot of the work focused, as was discussed in Professor Tamanaha's comments, relate to really a technical application of laws. And now more recently, almost all of my work has been working with security forces, police, and military. So as I surveyed the work of what we call rule of law, especially in the tumultuous environments in which we're finding ourselves in the security situation that we're seeing around the world, we only need to turn on the TV, especially recently in the last couple weeks, to see the dynamics that are playing out around the world and to see how important it is. And we all agree that it's very important. At the same time, those of us who've been involved in the work see that our work has often fallen short. And despite our best efforts, improvements are made, but there's much more that needs to be done in order for things to happen. So a lot of times we'll attribute these challenges to rule of law, especially in countries evolving from war, as well as because there was a war or there's corruption. And there's a lot of reasons why we say that there's no rule of law. But what I would almost say is I think that a lot of the challenges we're facing result from our assumptions that may be faulty when we're going in. So I'm going to briefly discuss just three faulty assumptions. One is that rule of law is a technical matter. Two, that our idea of rule of law existed at some point in the country. Or if not, well, that's okay. We could just recreate that notion of rule of law in the country in which we work. So we go into countries working to do, as I said, technical things, which I did early in my career, having worked on a book that was published on three volumes of model laws. And I'm not saying that these are not important things, but what I'm saying is we're scratching the surface and there's a lot more going on that I'll go into. So we focus on training, drafting constitutions, working with the formal institutions of law. And we assume that if we build that up, you know, the movie, you know, if you build it, they will come, from the baseball movie. We assumed that that was going to come into play. And I was a big fan of that, the movie. And the thought, but again, that was 10 years ago. So we go in and we assume there's a social contract already in place amongst the citizens that are in the country, much like the social contract we have in our own country. But in fact, as was mentioned by a number of panelists already, you know, when we work in Afghanistan, the fact is the majority of the country never had a formal justice system of law as we see it. It existed at best in Kabul and didn't function in the way that we would think it did. The majority of the country is resolved through other ways, tribal systems, customary, a very pluralistic legal society. And also, we also assume that the state in some of these countries are central to the provision of security and rule of law, and that that state is looking out for the best interests of the citizens as a whole. Or even if we don't believe it, we hope so, and we hope that we can bolster that. But in reality, many of the countries you work, there's a dictatorship or a government that didn't see the interests of the whole country as a whole in their best interest, or is governed, as the panelist said last time, by a small group of people that really run the country. And the whole system, the structure, the military, the economics, the rule of law, everything follows down that, and those who are in power rule, and those who don't do not and have no access to justice. And I think a lot of this we know through research. We know this through experience. And recently, over the past year, I've gone to a number of different countries trying to get a handle. And Leila Mooney, who is here, went with me to two of the countries. And we've gone to Nepal, Nicaragua, Peru, Kosovo, Liberia, Sudan. And we have two more countries to do. And we decided to turn it upside down because we tended to work on rule of law, as I would say, from the top down, from the formal institutions and the structures, with assumptions that we all had. So we went and we talked to the people. And when I mean the people, we didn't just talk to the people through their civil society groups that often are supposed to be looking out for the interests, because sometimes, as we've seen in many of the countries, civil society is just an extension of the existing political structures and are often governed through political interference or for money or will go where the funding goes. Now, I'm not saying that for all of the NGOs, and those of us who've worked with NGOs know there are excellent NGOs, but that is not always the case everywhere we go. So we went straight to individual people, talking to taxi cab drivers that we could corner on the street, talking to street vendors, talking to mothers, at the same time talking to other parts of society, including the military, police, and asking various questions, very simple questions, of what does rule of law mean to you? How do you define it? And is there security in your country? Why not? And what do you want the international community to know about you, your country? What advice would you give us? What experiences have you had with this? What do you think about it? And to try to get these viewpoints through. And what was interesting, I think, I'll say Brian now, since I keep using the formal name. I think what I found is when he said he was going to dumb down rule of law, I want to dumb it down even further, if that's possible. And what I would almost say is if I'm going to define rule of law, I would define it as it's all about relationships. It's about the people. And what I mean by that is where we see that there's an imbalanced power relationship between the people, and we assume that passing laws or setting up structures or introducing notions that of different definitions of rule of law, that alone this will remedy it. But if the power relationships are not there, that doesn't exist. And also when I talk about people, what I say at its foundation ultimately is that rule of law is set only when there's a level of trust and legitimacy. Trust and legitimacy between people and their system, whatever that may look like, because as was discussed in the last panel, there's different systems. It may not be the state, it may be, you know, local community systems of justice or how things work. And also between the civilians and the military, and between civilians and civilian organizations, civil society and civil society organizations. Until these relationships are harmonized, then it's very difficult to build any form of rule of law in a structured sense. So as you've seen in Egypt and other countries, and this is where I'm going to connect to the security forces. As we've seen in Egypt and other countries, the security forces in the country play a vital role in this trust and legitimacy situation. And we look at, are they enablers of an unjust society, or are they enablers of a just society? And what role do they play in that society? And do they look at themselves as keeping in power the elite, whoever that is, protection of a certain ethnic group, or do they look at themselves as a protector of the national interest as a whole? And what is the relationship between the civilian authorities? And some of these are very basic, but in the countries you work, it isn't basic. It's something we take for granted here, but it does not exist in many of the countries in which we're working. So violent conflict can rise or be prevented depending upon how that security force views their role vis-a-vis the people as a whole. And I was in Nepal last month, and I was speaking to a retired general who finally was able to speak frankly, because it's often very difficult when I work with military in different countries to speak honestly until a level of trust is built between myself or my group and the military folks, especially when they're active, because a lot of them are fearful. It's a cultural thing oftentimes, but also they may be brought up on war crimes charges. There's past atrocities, just a lot of different things that keep them fearful of discussing things. But it was interesting because he talked about how he was very progressive. He'd trained under both the UK and the US armies. And he had a very strong view of how things could move forward. And it was very basic and something that would help. But the reality is the political leaders in the country don't see it that way. They're busy at the top level fighting out control and the spoils and who gets what ministry. Because then you can get your family and friends into those positions. And they had no interest in what would help the country as a whole move forward, or really even a notion of what national security meant. It was security for their ruling group. And so he was trying to move the political parties by being an advisor behind the scenes to how creating security, national security, can be built by doing something very radical, and that's looking out at the interest of the country as a whole and trying to look at the rights of the minorities, their concerns, because if they would look back in history, they would see that oftentimes when the minority groups or certain groups were not being addressed, it allowed certain power players to step into the mix, and I know we'll talk about some of this with insurgencies, to exploit those gaps. And then we had the Maoist conflict. And they wouldn't have been able to draw in a lot of the fighters that they got, especially from the women and from the minority groups, had these inequities not existed at the time. So certain groups were able to capitalize on that. And he was trying to talk about that, but he wasn't getting very far. At the same time, with our own security forces, international security forces from whatever country, going into a UN mission or a peace in stabilization type mission, peace operation. How are we acting ourselves? What values are we setting forth and what are we mirroring? Are we mirroring the notions of rule of law even as we see it in our country, in that other country? And that's something that is very critical. At the same time, I'm not just saying it's the state, the military, the police and security forces that need to look at this. There's also the responsibility of people to act responsibly. Restraint and responsibility on a personal level. Nepal is another good example. They felt that when they toppled the king, and I was there in the last few days of the popular movement that overthrew the king. What was interesting is to them, they felt good. They thought, good, we got rid of him. Now it's free for all for us. And there was no sense of civil restraint or understanding what your role as a citizen is, and that if you have a grievance, you don't go and create violence and bonds and strike and beat people up. So there was that restraint on both sides, but they had nothing to, there was no witness before of what that looks like in their government, and so they were not following it on their own end. So what does it mean when we say that a foundation of rule of law does not exist, when there's no political will on behalf of the government, when you have security gaps? And in these cases where the top-down approach is very, very challenging and various diplomatic carrot and stick approaches are used. And again, I'll just say what Brian said that, you kind of figure what's the point at times. And I'm not going to say at certain points when you go into that, you figure what's the point when the country seems to be captured by groups that choose to not move forward. And so at those times, I thought, well, I really like organic gardening. I wonder if I could just expand that practice, leave rule of law, move down to Virginia and start an organic farm. This could be really fun. And I think I could actually, I plant, I see things, it grows. I know if there's something wrong, I can figure it out. And it's just much easier. But before giving up, I think the point is, it's trying to find out, okay, what are those entry points? We can't fix everything. So I'm going to talk about one thing, going back to my notion of trust and legitimacy. So one thing that we've been working on over the past year is a form of local level, bottom-up dialogue, facilitated dialogue. And what I mean by this is simply creating the neutral space for different groups to come together and to see their cultures, which they may see as so different, that may not be different after all. And what I mean by that is, I'm going to show you, what's my left hand? It's better to just show it by example. One is, oops, square button. Okay, now I messed it up. Okay, so I'm just going to, so one example is, in Nepal, when I was there, it was very clear that there was a huge divide between the police and the public, because the police had been used as an instrument of the government, basically to suppress the people, and they were very politically corrupt. But when I say that, does that mean every single police officer on the street was corrupt and there's no point? And same with the security forces. Does that mean every person in their military was corrupt? No. And so what it means is trying to identify those in the system. Yeah, it's right here. Those in the system who want a different future, who want the opportunity to create a different future, and are willing to bridge. So I call this a bridging exercise, where if you could bring those people who really want to see it, and there are plenty of them in the security forces, and there are plenty of them in civil society, and oftentimes they get caught up or they feel stuck in wherever they are. So if you can find that middle ground, of course there's people on both ends, where, like everywhere, that are not, you know, who don't want it to move forward. But if you can find them and give them a neutral space to meet together, they can find that they have sometimes more in common than differences. And so what we did is we brought together Nepal police and civil society and then later youth. And again, this takes time. When we talk about, you know, again, Brian, keep quoting you. I feel like I had thought with a lot of things you said I was going to be duplicating. But a lot of them, it takes time to change that culture. So what we've seen over 5 years, where before it was literally just getting them into a room, and then after lots of yelling and blaming and going through processes, they started to see each other as human beings, and they started to work together. So now when they have problems, they'll call each other up. And what happened in one district, it's this one right here, the youth, what they were doing is the senior leaders, the political party, were using the youth for violent means, like little vigilantes. So what they did is the police wanted to meet with the youth because they'd had experiences with this, and it was in one border area of India. And they met with the police, and they worked together, and they came up with a joint agreement that the youth wouldn't do certain things if the police agreed to do certain things to help. In short, after a year, after the crime wave of murders and kidnappings had gone down significantly in the year, the police attributed that to this dialogue, and also they had the strikes and the number of violent bonds that usually went on had significantly decreased. And that it was actually very emotional. And the photo up above, this is a police officer, senior police officer, who's sitting there very stoically, you know, no smiles, very formal, very structured. And it was his last going away party. He was trying to keep it together because it isn't cool to cry and show this display of emotion in this environment. But when it came time for the youth to honor him, they would put the tikka on his head. He had tikka on his whole entire forehead. And you could tell he was getting a little bit emotional in the youth. And that was a testament to this. Now, is Nepal breaking out in peace? No. Has the political structure changed? No. Will it? We don't know. But what's happening is, at least at a local level, there are seeds being planted and relationships being built and legitimacy being changed. And the youth, you know, those of us who are in our late 40s are considered youth in Nepal. You can be a youth party member till you're 52. right, we're still there. But the youth are these 40, you know, this police officer was in his late 40s. They will be the leaders in the future, because older leaders who are in their 70s and 80s will eventually have to pass the torch. So anyway, that's one example. And the other one is in Guatemala, which has a much, it's the next slide. Okay, in Guatemala, you know, anyone who knows the history of Guatemala, and I know there are quite a few here who've experienced it, it is, not only is it dealing with a huge crime problem, gang problem, it's still living with the legacy of a substantial human rights abuses on the part of the state in their attempt to deal with what they felt was a growing insurgency. And so the challenge is the military now, most of the people in the military that we met with weren't even part of this, or if they were, they were very young. But what's happening is as they're trying to make a change and trying to move forward in a professional way, they've been working with the U.S. Army a lot, they can't get back from their past because the people in power who are still there, some generals and others, aren't going to let that happen. They don't want to be accountable. And so what ended up happening is at this point, we worked through a dialogue where we brought together some of the key human rights victim organizations quietly together with some of the military and slowly had an introduction. And it was very interesting. Again, it's the beginning of the process, but you have to just look at these things as small things. In the very beginning, everyone was sitting apart from each other. And then after the second day at a break, there was a special forces soldier who, you know, wasn't talking to anybody. He, you know, everyone's kind of avoiding certain people. All of a sudden, you saw him talking to one of the human rights advocates who was very, very strong, and they were off talking. And as the week went on, you saw some of these things breaking. You saw some cards being passed. Now, again, is peace breaking out in Guatemala? No, they have a huge crime problem. Are the past human rights abuses being addressed? No, not right now. But are we starting on that progress? Are we starting to change some of the minds at this place, even though they're being, you know, the system right now captures that? And then the last thing before I conclude is it's not up here, but it's our international forces, which our next two panels will talk about in more detail. In working in Kosovo, there was a huge divide, even on the international side, between civilian and military, where the military was engaged in a lot of rule of law activities. And one of them revolved around detainee operations. And so the human rights organizations from the international organizations were very upset about how that was being done. And it was a very destructive process at the time where they were polarized because the military felt they were being attacked unfairly. The human rights organizations, the international organizations were running these very caustic reports and it just nothing, and against the UN, and it was very destructive. But through a process of bringing people together and talking about how you can constructively engage with the military, how you can try to bridge these cultures, you can actually make a positive change. And so that was just an example, again, of bringing together and bridging the civilian and military divide that sometimes you find in these systems. So in conclusion, what I would argue is that it's really that we try to get back to the basics. And I think a lot of times we've lost that in our rule of law work overseas. You know, even though a lot of organizations have moved beyond the courthouse's laws and training, and for better or worse, our experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan have helped that accelerate that process. We still need to realize that even with all of the rule of law interventions, we really need to focus on the relationships in society and the values that society holds and upholds. And the answer is resoundingly that came back from all of the people I talked to when I asked them, what does rule of law mean to you? When you would pare it down to the basic essentials, it was very simple. And it was really about fairness and accountability. People just wanted something to be fair. And they just wanted accountability for those people, whatever it looked like. You know, we can talk about how that looks in that society, because obviously it's going to be different, as other speakers have talked about. We don't need to talk about the structures, but what at its foundation is fair. And then without that, what we'll do is continue to be stuck in a cycle of violence. And I use Guatemala as an example, and I work a lot on residual violence issues, and we see it repeatedly. Countries come from conflict, then violent conflict, then they revolve and evolve into what we're seeing in Latin America with, you know, drug trade. Because we're not patching together these the social fabric at some level, we just keep cycling to different levels of violence. And since I'm here at University of Virginia, I'm going to quote, you know, one of my favorite people. And it was my favorite before I came here. Okay, so just a couple of Thomas Jefferson quotes that I think kind of, capture this, and I will let you read those without me ruining them. Thank you.
Thank you. So I should say the general plan is to hear remarks of between 15 and 20 minutes from each of the panelists, and then to take general questions from the audience. Thank you, Colette. I'm excited to work out an exchange program where you come and do organic gardening in Virginia, and I go to Nepal, where I will be a youth for another entire year. Our next panelist, Tom Nachbar, is a professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. He is also a reserve officer in the U.S. JAG Corps, and I assume he will draw on both of those experiences in his remarks. I can also tell you, Charlottesville being the small town that it is, that my children babysit for Tom and his wife.
Very ably.
And they report that it is easier when the children are asleep. That Tom is a little stern, but his wife is very nice.
That's odd, because she always seems very stern to me.
She knows how to play her cards.
Yeah. So thanks, John. Thanks, Colette. So it's true that I am both a law professor and I'm also an Army Reserve Judge Advocate. Today I'm obviously in my law professor costume. Nothing I say is associated or affiliated or should stand in any way as part of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, the Office of the Judge Advocate General, or anybody else who holds any position of responsibility whatsoever. I want to talk a little bit about security forces and what security forces often do in rule of law. They work in rule of law in a lot of ways, and I'm going to focus on international security forces. Of course, security forces can be involved in rule of law programs a lot of ways. Domestic security forces are involved in rule of law a lot, hopefully. But I'm going to focus on the role of international security forces. Usually, they don't do much in terms of rule of law development. A lot of the programs really don't involve international security forces. If they do, traditionally, they tend to be involved in engagements with host nation security forces. That is, for instance, U.S. Military will go and help train foreign militaries, but you don't see U.S. military forces going and working with judiciaries in many countries, right? Those two uses, this direct engagement, is not terribly controversial, but sometimes their international security forces become much, much more involved during things like military government or occupation, which has historically been rare and today is essentially non-existent as a formal matter to the point that U.S. denies that it occupies or occupied Iraq. But there's one context where you do see sustained involvement of security forces in rule of law writ large, and that's in post-conflict and largely in post-conflict environments that are not really post-conflict yet. I've always liked to refer to what U.S. security forces are doing abroad these days as pre-post-conflict. And that's counterinsurgency, dealing with in the aftermath of a major conflict, frequently there'll be an insurgency or perhaps the conflict involved an insurgency, and fighting that insurgency through counterinsurgency. In an insurgency, one group challenges the government for control, and the question then is really who's in control. That comes down to who the population thinks is in control, not who the UN recognizes as in control. Or put another way, it's who the population sees as their legitimate rulers. So insurgency and counterinsurgency is really a contest for legitimacy among the population. And this ties back to a lot of what Colette was talking about with regard to legitimacy. The Army's counterinsurgency manual defines victory in a counterinsurgency is achieved when the populace it consents to the government's legitimacy and stops actively and passively supporting the insurgency. So when the population decides that they like the government, that's the victory condition. You see that happening today in Afghanistan. There's a contest at some level for control, for governance control, between the government of Afghanistan and informal mechanisms, some of which operate consistently with the government of Afghanistan, and some, like the Taliban, are inconsistent with the government of Afghanistan. And you see that happening consistently, where the Taliban, much of their appeal to the population is their ability to engage in dispute resolution. So that being said, right, drawing any real conclusion about law's role in counterinsurgency requires one to describe how law, and along with law, legal institutions are used in counterinsurgency. And I think I'd like to suggest that there are actually four distinct ways in which law and legal institutions are used in counterinsurgency, and those four ways can actually alternatively be described either as direct or indirect uses. So first, counterinsurgents use the law with all of its normal retributive, deterrent, and incapacitory effects as a weapon against insurgents. Right? In this sense, the criminal justice system is essentially a substitute for lethal targeting against insurgents and locks them up instead of killing them, right, as a way to directly affect the insurgency, as my last sentence suggests. This is a direct use of the law in insurgency or in counterinsurgency. Second, counterinsurgents can engage in capacity building of the host nation's criminal legal institutions because those institutions have value in providing the first effect, right? So instead of, you know, you want to lock people up, well, you can't lock people up if you don't have a criminal justice system. So if you're a counterinsurgent, you want to both go around locking people up and you want to build the system that's going to help you lock them up. The primary difference here is in the scope of what you're trying to do and in the type of behavior. So in the first use, you actually participate in the criminal justice system, and it's very lawyer-heavy, understandably. The second use is not about being a lawyer so much as it is about capacity building. And it's not clear that lawyers have a particularly central role in this type of capacity building, or at least I didn't take any classes in law school about capacity building. So it could be that being a lawyer would be helpful, but there's another skill set that one might use. This, I think, is a direct use of the law. The objective is to lock up insurgents, but it's done through an indirect means, right? Development, instead of actually going to the criminal justice system. Third, counterinsurgents can build the capacity of criminal legal institutions because using those legal institutions to fight insurgents actually enhances the legitimacy of the government. So, right, in this way, the idea would be that the population views the government's fight as being more legitimate because that fight is taking place through legal institutions, and you can see that happening in a couple of ways. The first is that it gives the host nation the rhetorical advantage of labeling insurgents criminals, right? So if you use the legal system against insurgents, and by doing so you're able to label them criminals, you get some advantage there. Instead of having them viewed as freedom fighters. And second, the population might view the government's cause as being more fair because they think the use of legal institutions provides more fair outcomes. So maybe we think that blowing somebody up is, you know, it's easy to make a mistake when you decide to blow someone up, but if you arrest them and they get a trial and all these procedures, well, then the consequence, being locked up, we think that that leads to more accurate outcomes, or we have a fair understanding. That, I think, is an indirect use of the law. It's not really using it against insurgents. It's using it to do something else, build the government's legitimacy that furthers the fight against insurgents, and in a sense by legitimating the government's other direct actions against insurgents. Fourth, devotion to law and legal institution can enhance the government's legitimacy as the primary objective, right? This use can have wide-ranging consequences that have little direct relation to the counterinsurgency itself, but are a demonstration of the government's overall commitment to the rule of law. Sometimes that commitment results in a short-term victory for insurgents. So if one arrests someone that you know that they're an insurgent and you put them through the criminal justice system and they're not convicted and they get released, well, that's a short-term victory for insurgents. And hopefully the idea is that over the long term, that short-term failure inures to the benefit of the government by demonstrating its commitment to the rule of law. This is the most indirect use of the law, I think, in counterinsurgency, but I think it may also be the most powerful. If legitimacy is really the objective in a counterinsurgency, there's practically no stronger way to build that legitimacy than through these types of means. Anti-corruption would be an example of this, right, where anti-corruption efforts are not directed specifically against insurgents necessarily, but they build the people's faith in the government. And building that faith in the government is what leads to the success of the counterinsurgency. So I think that there are two consequences of thinking about the use of law or the rule of law in this way. The first is to contrast counterinsurgency to counterterrorism. So there's right now there's a there's been and there continues to be a debate over what the right strategy is in places like Afghanistan about whether to engage in a full counterinsurgency strategy in an attempt to legitimate the government of Afghanistan or to engage in a more limited counterterrorism strategy that seeks to deny Afghanistan as a safe haven for the development of terrorist networks that can strike at the United States. Depends on whether you have a, you know, strictly a defense understanding about what the about what our purpose is in Afghanistan. If it's just to stop strikes against the United States, the argument goes you can engage in a more limited strategy, and building legitimacy of the government of Afghanistan has proven to be something of a challenge over the last, century. So it's appealing, right? The problem, I think, is that focusing on counterterrorism as a possibility, right, ignores these indirect effects and ignores this indirect use of law. One can directly use law against terrorists, but if you really want to get these indirect benefits, which I think are very strong, one has to engage in a broader counterinsurgency capacity building strategy. The second has to do with the temporal dimension in conflicts and how law is used. So recognizing the close relationship between what I call direct uses of the law and indirect uses of the law explains a lot about the development of current coalition rule of law efforts in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Military doctrine treats conflicts like campaigns. They go through stages. There's, and this is dramatic oversimplification, but the later stages of the campaign after major conflict or after major combat is over, there is a capacity building or stability operations phase, and the idea is to enable the local civil authorities to carry out the conduct of that nation's affairs. What has happened, though, of course, you can't ignore the fact that those capacity building efforts were preceded by major combat operations. And in both Iraq and Afghanistan, major centralized rule of law development efforts have grown out of actual detention operations that have been conducted by coalition forces. So a group in Iraq, Task Force 134, and currently in Afghanistan, combined joint interagency task force 435, things get more complicated the further you go, were actually originally charged with the specific problem of managing detention centers and have grown into capacity building operations as they tried to build the capacity of the host nation's institutions in doing and managing detention and managing the insurgent population, at least those who've been detained. And now 435, I'm just going to call it 435, has spun off a dedicated capacity building organization called the Rule of Law Field Force Afghanistan that doesn't do detention at all. They only do capacity building, but it's populated almost entirely by military members. And if you looked at some of the programs that they were conducting, they wouldn't look like detention programs at all. So one of them, for instance, is an education program to help detainees do something other than fight when they are released. The RALF has a program now where they've gone into districts and they've tried to help develop informal dispute resolution systems with both government and non-governmental actors, recognizing that much of their competition, the Taliban, is about doing informal private dispute resolution. So now you have military organizations, largely military organizations, that are going out and helping to build informal, horizontal, right, private ordering dispute systems and trying to support those because they recognize that that's a way to have the population turn away from their competitors, the Taliban, and toward either the Afghan government or an informal group that operates under the auspices of the Afghan government. And really, when you think about it, right, this progression makes a lot of sense, right? Going from, if you have a large group of individuals who are operating a host nation's detention system, they're going to spend a lot of time working with the host nation's security forces. They're going to be in a fantastic position to use the relationship they've built, to the extent that rule of law is about relationships, to shift from operating detention facilities into capacity building the host nation's detention facilities and adjacent elements of the host nation's rule of law infrastructure, as it were. The military centrality to the latter it being involved in, you can tell I skipped a sentence there, it being involved in capacity building is a consequence of the fact that they were necessarily involved in detention operations to begin with. Not everybody's happy with this development. Many people view it as the militarization of rule of law capacity building, but it's a predictable consequence of these particular conflicts. Concerns about militarization, I think, are unlikely to be fully erased so long as such missions are conducted in the context of ongoing and active armed conflict. The question then is, what do you do about it? And there are a lot of different things that you can do about it. American civilian government institutions have been ramping up. There's now a quarterly diplomacy and development review that is supposed to mirror the Defense Department's quadrennial defense review. And if you read it, it largely ignores the military's role in this type of capacity building. It's understandable that they would do so. But I think a major, you know, in addition to building U.S. government and NGO civilian resources in this area, I think a major component of this is going to include making sure that the military can take as active a part in capacity building as it does in using the law for direct effects against insurgents and other adversaries. If not, I think we're likely to not only be less effective in counterinsurgency, and I think we'll be fighting counterinsurgencies for some time, but also we'll likely rely too heavily on the law's direct effects without considering its indirect effects.
Thank you, Tom. I was taught, if I recall correctly, that there are 6 uniformed services of the United States government: the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Coast Guard, and the Public Health Service, the one that usually wins you the trivia question. Our final panelist, Commander Reese, has concentrated on the 3 manliest of those services: the Marines, where he was a sergeant, the Navy, where he is a commander, and the Army, which hosts him currently at its JAG school just across the street. He has experience in the Pacific, as well as Kosovo and Iraq, and I welcome his remarks.
Thank you, sir. Well, first, before I begin, I'd like to thank Ms. Leonard and Ms. Higgs for inviting me to participate in the J.B. Moore Society of International Law. I'm honored to be here, and I'm especially honored to share the dais with John Collette and Tom, because I'm a first-year instructor at the institution next door here on the North Grounds, the Army Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. And so I find myself asking the question today that I asked myself when I first arrived in Iraq for my first tour: what am I doing here? And I think that the answer might be the same for both questions, or for that single question, and for the practitioners, particularly those uniformed judge advocates that are executing stability operations, particularly rule of law lines of operation in our deployed environments in Iraq and Afghanistan. We are there to get out, and we are there because we need to practice stability operations in the counterinsurgency environment, the pre-post-conflict environment, as Tom said, because it's part of our doctrine. So what I'd like to do today is, to the extent that I can, orient you to what we're training the practitioners who are deploying to these environments to do, so that we may be successful in executing these stability operation missions. That's what I'm going to do. I've heard my predecessors today talk about dumbing things down. I am a prior enlisted Marine. I'm going to break it down Barney style for you, as a young Marine told me once while I was deployed to Iraq for the second time. And so even though I'm in service dress blues today, I should be in a purple dinosaur suit, because we're going to make it really, really basic at this point. We're going to take it right down to the muddy boot level. As Tom said, and I do need to make a disclaimer here at the beginning, I'm expressing my personal views here, and they don't necessarily, to the extent that I talk doctrine or talk about training, my views don't necessarily reflect those of the United States government, the Department of Defense, more specifically the Department of the Navy, or the Army Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. What do we do next door, and why are we training judge advocate practitioners and members of the interagency from U.S. government in rule of law? And the reason is because we're there and we're doing it, and this role has been, in a way, thrust upon us. My first experience, just personally speaking, in 2004 was that when I arrived in Baghdad, thinking that as an operational lawyer with deployed experience that I would be advising commanders about the rules of engagement or the law of armed conflict and some of those traditional things that that I had learned about, and was told that, no, you're going to be working for Task Force 134 and helping to prosecute insurgents before the first court of national jurisdiction. I just think, wow, that's not what I trained to do. That's not what I prepared to do. But because that was our role, because we were there and that we needed to do it, we very quickly recognized that we needed to build the capacity of our practitioners and ensure that they were better prepared than I when they deployed downrange. So I'll talk a little bit about what we do and how we prepare those folks to go and work with the host nation security forces or the host nation governments, both at the strategic level and the tactical level, in executing this particular line of operation. I thought it was great that we started off with the idea of a definition of the rule of law. And in academia, of course, you know, that's up for debate, and there are different definitions and all of the rest. But remember, we're Barney style down at my level. I have a definition, and I brought a few books that we use. It's a practitioner's guide for judge advocates that our Center for Law and Military Operations puts out here at the Army JAG School, the Rule of Law Handbook. And there's a definition contained inside of it. It's contained in our Stability Operations Manual. My definition is clear. It comports very closely with the Freedom Houses. It is almost a mirror image of the United Nations definition of rule of law. And it is very, very aspirational. But it is a definition nonetheless. It is ours, and it's specific. So one of the first things I do when I train our young judge advocate practitioners who are preparing to deploy to the pre-post-conflict environment, such as Iraq or Afghanistan, I tell them that we know exactly what the rule of law is and the definition of it. It may differ from place to place. It may differ from place to place within a particular country. But our definition as practitioners, as uniformed service members, is clear. It's in our rules. And that's what we need to aspire to, no matter how challenging it actually is. So that's critical that we debunk that particular myth, because as Rosa Brooks and James Stromseth said in a book that I think was mentioned earlier, Can Might Make Rights, you don't want to go into a rule of law operation, a stability operation mission as a uniformed service member with a Justice Potter Stewart approach, as in his obscenity case. I'll know it when I see it when I get over there. That's not very good. You need to know what you're supposed to aspire to. And with all due respect to everyone that's involved in this and the folks who have spoken today, it is well defined, but it's enormously challenging, and you may never reach that aspirational goal. So I very quickly transition into talking about realistic expectations of what can be accomplished in the counterinsurgency environment. What can really be done, both at a strategic level or a tactical level? And again, the people that we're training to work with those local security forces, to work with those local councils, are typically officers like me, about the same rank. And we're going to be down there at the tactical level. We're going to be working with the battalions and the brigade combat teams, and engaging in a very fundamental way with locals. And I particularly tell people, and I think it's important to note here, that it's not just a strategic effort. We understand that it's necessary to have grassroots movements, and Colette talked a little bit about how important it is to engage people in those extra-governmental systems, in those informal, customary dispute resolution processes, and not concede them to people like the Taliban, because that's where you can really make your money. That's where we're operating, and it's important for us to engage the local population and be able to engage them in a way that lets them know that we are sensitive to their cultural norms and understand that they may not trust the more formal system in Kabul or Baghdad, for that matter. So I debunk that myth pretty quickly too, the definitional myth, and then the idea that we're only working up at the state government level, the federal government level, or strategic level. We really are practicing at the muddy boot level. And I think something that Tom said is very, very important. The skills that the people need to learn aren't necessarily legal skills. And we're talking more and more about the, not necessarily the militarization of rule of law mission, but the anthropological approach to rule of law missions, and the idea that maybe it isn't a lawyer that's best suited to do these things in the deployed environment. Maybe it's a cultural anthropologist who can explain to you why it's really not that big a deal that a person in Liberia, for instance, ingests a little bit of dirt to compel honest testimony in a land dispute case, and that you can tolerate that kind of difference from your own experience here in the United States. Just something like that for an example. And I think more and more that it's our negotiating skills that become key when we meet with those local populations. We certainly know the law, and we know what the codes are, and we can be trained in Sharia, or we can be trained in formal justice systems. And we certainly do that to a certain degree before we deploy. But what I think is alien to a lot of people is this notion that it's not going to just be about imposing a constitution. It's not going to be about imposing a civil code or a criminal code on local people. That doesn't work, and we've learned that lesson. We talk an awful lot about how important it is to cooperate with our interagency partners, and it's taken us a while to get to the point where we realize that not only is it the United States government interagency partners that are vital to our success moving forward, whether we're at the tactical level or the strategic level, we need to work with our international partners as well, and those non-governmental organizations that that are in our areas of operation. So I have what I call a day of unity during my training, where we actually invite members of the interagency and folks from the United States Institute of Peace and the rest to come and talk to us about what their capabilities and capacities and authorities are, because I think really the challenge for a lot of us is that we know what we're supposed to do, we know what we're supposed to aspire to. Generationally, even U.S. military has been engaged in security sector reform, reconstruction, and stabilization. It's not as though we don't know what we're supposed to do, but we don't coordinate and cooperate very well. That's changing. Tom talked about Combined Joint Interagency Task Force 435, Brigadier General Martin's outfit in Afghanistan, and the idea that after a decade of doing this stuff, we've finally come around to the notion that we need to have a weekly meeting called the Council of Deputies to figure out what everybody's doing in the area of operation before we actually execute these stability operations, rule of law operation efforts. And that's a great thing. It's a good thing. Well, we do that here in the pre-deployment environment, let people know, listen, break down those stovepipes, get yourself prepared to go into a very different environment, and understand that there will be other actors that are there with you that need to absolutely positively cooperate to move the ball forward. So that's it really in a nutshell, what I do next door, and how we recognize as uniformed military members that it's really not a matter of going over there and being so blunt an instrument as to just conduct combat operations. The doctrine that I mentioned tells us that stability operations are on par with combat operations. They are equally as important, and they are as important to the general commanding the forces that are in the field as it is to the private that's on the ground that is probably interacting more often than not with that local population. So we get it. DOD certainly understands the need to cooperate. We understand how challenging it is to execute the rule of law mission, however you define it. But we're a learning institution, certainly, that is mindful of the challenges and is trying to capture lessons learned and move forward. I don't want to take up too much time. I'm mindful that I am the only thing between you and questions and the reception. So I'll wrap things up there, and I invite your questions. I am happy to discuss with you either my own personal experience from the podium as a teacher, or deployed experience in Iraq times two and Kosovo once. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here to speak to you. I appreciate it.